This is the Tribal Medicaid Assisted Treatment Program, HOOPA. I could call it HTMAT, but I just call it Tribal Medicaid Assisted Treatment, TMAT. I got that name and that concept at a training I did in San Diego, and we was up there at Pala and Rincon reservations, and that's what they call it. And I'm like, that sounds good, Tribal MAT, because that's what we are. I'm under Kamau Medical Center at the clinic. I'm under Eva Smith. Originally, it started at Behavioral Health, and we do work closely with Behavioral Health. They help us with our outsourcing treatment, sending people to residential detox and stuff like that. So Damon Cross is over there doing a spectacular job with that funding and those resources.
We've got yourself, Jack McNerney.
Yes, Jack McNerney.
And McCoubie. Jesse McCoubie.
And we are T-Mat.
All right. So we're going to be talking about the TMAT program here.
Yes.
And all the services that are rendered to the Hoopla Valley community. Do you expand beyond Hoopla?
We have clients in Wichipec, and we've had a few clients come from Willow Creek. We have a few clients out there in Orleans. And so we take people as they come.
Okay.
So we can't have people too far away. We don't have any clients in Eureka, for example. Okay. That's too far away.
So you're doing Eastern Humboldt County.
Eastern Humboldt County, yes.
All right. Focus here. All right. Yeah. Along the two rivers.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is what we're talking about. We're going to be talking about TMAT and the program. We're going to explain it by the numbers. So Jack, give us some background and how did this get started and what are your focus?
In 2018, around January, a funding source came through, and an order came down to address the opioid crisis. Dr. Smith and the Kamau board voted to start the Medicaid Assisted Treatment, or TMAT. The first induction for Suboxone was in April of 2018 in the Kamau Medical Center. And then there was an additional one also in April of that year, 2018. And then the program was, they didn't have no counselor. They didn't have no advocate for it, even though Behavioral Health was there and Damon Cross was a counselor for that program. They'd have nobody specific for the program. And they were advertising for the position. And I applied for the position in June of 2018 and was hired almost immediately. I went through my interview process, got hired. So I started with two clients in June of 2018, just doing small groups in a clinic. And from there, we have grown to 43 clients, active clients right now. We have 25 of those clients are working, and 41 of those clients are stable. We have three that we're working with and trying to help in a variety of different ways, offering treatment and additional counseling, dose changes and stuff like that. So we've seen over 200 clients total. We've seen a number of people. At one point, we've had 50 active clients on our list. We've just been out in the community. We've just been seeing people and helping and providing services the best way we can, counseling. Sometimes I feel like a social worker more than I do a counselor, because a lot of my clients come to us without a driver's license, you know, without IDs and stuff like that, and without any social services at all. And a lot of them are homeless. So we just have to just meet them where they're at. And so a lot of it happens out in the field and sometimes helping them when they can't help themselves. And so that's how the program got going. I'm going to say with our numbers right now, or is very successful. The people who are engaging in the program and utilizing the resources and the medication, taking as prescribed, are doing very, very well. So I'm very happy about that.
Jesse, what's your background and your work history?
I started back in December of 2019. I'm part of the opioid epidemic through the EDD department, going through the SMART Center. So I'm an intern. I've been working since December 2019 with Jack McNerney, Eva Smith. Just learning the ropes, starting off, and working towards my credentials.
Yeah, we see you two drive around in that van. Like, ah, this is a team.
Yes, yes. Jesse's been a great asset, you know, especially during the COVID and having to go out in the field, you know, because before that, before COVID, everybody had to come to the clinic. And I'm sitting in my office or I'm over in the group room waiting for the group or for the counseling session. And if people don't come, they don't come. You know, if they don't make it, they don't make it. Well, when the COVID happened, we had to take the medication to the clients. If they were shut down the clinic, nobody was going in. They weren't doing no drug tests. They weren't doing no groups. They weren't social distancing. Everybody was in a panic. And so we had to go out in the field to address and to help our clients. And even though I grew up in Wishbeck and went to school here in Hoopa, that's all I did was on the bus here and on the bus back. So I didn't really know Hoopa that well. And so Jesse knows, he grew up here, and he was able to assist in finding all our clients. So I don't know how my clients feel about it, but I know where they all live at now. So,
well, that's good, because that's another group of the community, and
mm-hmm.
You're all working together. So is there any interaction, any ways that the group meets? You know, do you do like Zoom calls or anything like that, or any other?
Damon has a daily Zoom, is it, or weekly?
A daily devotion at 8:15 through the Zoom. So, that's the only thing we've got going on right now.
Okay, I was just wondering you mentioned you waiting in your office for the groups to come, and they didn't come. But
yeah.
Now they can't. So is there a way that they can socialize together, you know, compare notes or interact?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're working on creating our own Zoom account. I know our 12-step group, which is one of the things that we, outside of our regular MAT or TMAT counseling and group services that we provide, we also require our clients to attend 12-step meetings. And so we have a base here in Hoopa that we meet at the hotel Mondays and Fridays. And so we're trying to get that Zoom meeting up and going again. And I've recently received some funding regarding being able to, do the updated or the more costly Zoom. Because Zoom is free, but if you want some extra perks on your Zoom, you can purchase it. So I think that's where we're headed with our Zoom meetings. And just for our TMAP program, our meetings, I will hope to get them started. I'm not sure about doing the Zoom. I see my clients on a daily, at least a weekly basis. We, as you said, we see us traveling in that van. We're traveling all over, seeing our clients, you know, seeing how they're doing, checking on their well-being and how the medication is working for them, trying to remove barriers and help them move forward in life. So
is this what you call harm reduction? What is that?
Harm reduction. Let me see if I have a... Harm reduction is all about minimizing harm, reducing the negative impact addiction has over someone's life, and keeping people alive long enough to get them help, basically. That's on just a personal counselor to client, physician to client, therapist to client. But harm reduction is a way broader. It has a lot more components financially and community-wide. The amount of money that has been spent on law enforcement and fighting the war on drugs, they could be spending that money on rehabilitation services, what they call prohibition. Doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's never worked. So I think the money can be best served. The money can best be used providing services, harm reduction, treatment centers, and medicated assisted treatment. And I think that's kind of what harm reduction is. And a lot of people have been raised to on the abstinence model, 12-step abstinence-based model. And that does serve people who are at rock bottom, ready to change, but it doesn't really serve the people who are still in their active addiction and need a little help, need a little coaching, need a sympathetic ear and somebody to talk to help them get over the rough time that they're going through. So harm reduction is that. On a financial level, we spend billions of dollars fighting supply and demand. But we don't spend any, we spend very little resources financing treatment that would help reduce the demand itself also. Every death, opioid death, every overdose, every infection, HIV, hepatitis C, has a very costly number associated with it. And when people are using Suboxone, those numbers go down significantly. And when those numbers go down, the savings on the other end are savings that can be used also for help or for in other areas for whatever. It's just money that is saved by less overdose, less infection from syringes. That's why the needle exchange is such an important component also to harm reduction. It will lessen the infections and the overdoses, or the infections specifically.
It must have a bearing on an effect on the emotions of family and friends and community as well. That as you're working with individuals and they're getting better and they're healing and you reduce their need or their demand, and it must have a positive effect on people around them as well.
It's an amazing thing. In many cases, when I'm dealing with somebody who's in their active addiction, I'm getting a certain vibe, a feel for what that person is like in their addiction. They're hustling. They are still out there doing what they do to stay alive, to survive, because in many cases they need the drug. They need to get high. They need it. And then when they get on board and start using the medication, Suboxone, and what Suboxone does is help them get through the withdrawal, because there's so many clients that are afraid to get clean because they do not want to go through the withdrawal. They don't want to do it. So Suboxone, under a supervised setting where they have a doctor and a nurse sitting there with them and monitoring when they're actually in withdrawal and ready to take the medication, and then they don't get sick, and then they can comfortably, just detox off the drug. And the other component is that when they take the Suboxone, they're not going to be able to use the other drug, heroin or any other opiate, for at least 48 hours. 72 is the timeline, but I would say 48 hours is when the Suboxone starts to, or the naloxone in the Suboxone starts to wear off. And people could probably, you know, feel some effect from another opiate, because it doesn't, even though that's when the binding on the opiate receptor is like loosened up, and maybe another opiate can slip in there. But so in those periods, but those periods of times when you take a person from addiction to having some real thoughts and real conversations with you, some emotions and associated with cleaning up and having a clearer mind. It's amazing. It's kind of why we do this work, and some of the really positive, you know, effects. And then, as I said, we have 25 working clients. You know, that's a direct impact on our community. You know, 25 people who were not working, who are now working, you know, providing revenue, taking care of their families and stuff like that. Those are important numbers and statistics that the community, but families also. I mean, can you imagine your son, your daughter was out there, you know, living in a car, you know, living in the woods, and now they're working and have their kids back and stuff like that. So it's really positive stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine that. Wow. You earlier you're talking about, and I was getting the impression that a person would have to be, to get the Suboxone treatment, they'd have to be shown that they're going into withdrawal symptoms. I wasn't clear on that.
Yes. Well, if you take Suboxone and you're on using heroin or using opiates, and you take Suboxone and you're not in withdrawal, you are going to get put in immediate withdrawal. You're going to get sick. That's why the medically supervised part of it is, right? If you take it before you're in, if you take Suboxone before you're in withdrawal, you're going into immediate withdrawal. You're going to get sick, and you're going to say, "What the f- did you give me? What are you doing to me?" Because you're going to be sick really quick. Okay. And so that's why the doctor is going to decide when you're actually in withdrawal, and is going to give you the medication, and then you won't be sick.
Okay, so then you have to be there before you get to that point, to the withdrawal point. So how is that arranged?
A person comes in, and the first person they're going to see in a normal setting is myself or Jesse. They're going to fill out an intake for the MAT TMAT program. And then it's just a few pages to read and sign. And normally we tell them on the phone, or we tell their family member, or we tell whoever it is that is helping support this situation for this client, come in withdrawal. If you want to come in withdrawal, and you'll get help. There's going to be a few clients that are going to come in and they're not in withdrawal. I can see them sitting across their desk from me, and I'll ask them, and they'll say, "I used this morning." And I'm going to tell them, "Well, you're not getting no medication today. I'll let you know." Right? Or I ask them, "When do you normally go? When do you normally need some more opiates?" There's some people who shoot or ingest opiates 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day. So sometimes they will be going in withdrawal like later in that afternoon, you know, and I'll say, "Well, let me know when it's a good time for you to see the doctor, you know, so that we can get that medically supervised situation straightened out for you."
Yep. Okay. Yeah. So then you have a doctor on hand right there at the clinic.
Yes. Right. So we have Dr. Smith, and we have Dr. Radar who helps. And we also have two other physicians who are thinking about getting waivered. And waivered would be going online and taking a test to become a waivered prescribing physician, which is what you need to be able to prescribe Suboxone. you can't just prescribe it, you know, just without having that waiver.
Yeah, I would imagine, because if you misdiagnose, then you're going to make that person sick.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're going to say, what the?
But I do want to point out, just, you know, treatment detox is our first line of defense here, which is why we still have this behavioral health component, because we always want to offer detox first, and they can use Suboxone while they detox in a really closely supervised situation, and they can get detoxed, and they can either go to residential or come back to Hoopa, but clean, detoxed, but using Suboxone, and they can enter our program just like that. They will already have a prescription from the detoxing center, and then they will come back here, and we will continue their treatment here in the valley.
And that's with Suboxone?
Yeah, that's with Suboxone.
But then they don't need it, though.
Yes, they used it to detox in a detox center. So there's two kinds of detox over there, right? They give you a Z-Pack. You know, it's where you're going to be hurting, you know, you're going to suffer. Or they give you Suboxone, where you don't suffer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's two kinds of detox, even in a regular detox facility. And given the choice, a good number of people will choose Suboxone. So they're using Suboxone while they're detoxing. And so they come back, and that's how they kind of went through it, just a little more closely supervised. They could do the same thing here in our treatment center. But this is just a little more supervised. It has a better chance of the client following through, because they're seen by a doctor like every day, hourly. They have a nurse on hand, you know, they're in a detox center, as opposed to out here, they see us and they come in for their appointment, which might be 2 or 3 hours, and then they leave, you know. Well, in the detox setting, they're not leaving for, you know, a few days until they're medically cleared or have tested negative for all illicit substances. So that's just kind of a difference. I would encourage that. And we have a funding source to be able to pay for those services. And so that's some of our first line stuff that we offer. But obviously, it's up to the client. It's up to the individual what they want to do. And by our numbers, we have a very good success rate either way we do it. But I encourage the detox for our most resistant, hardcore people who are not wanting to go through the withdrawals and are not trusting what I'm saying about the withdrawals. You know, they're just resistant. And I don't know if you've ever been through a withdrawal. I don't know if you know people who have been through a withdrawal, but sometimes it gets pretty hectic.
Yeah, that's why I was asking, and because it wasn't clear, like, here's your cure, but it's not like that. So everybody's different.
Yes, absolutely. I've only been through withdrawal one time, or a serious withdrawal, I guess, and that was when I was 18, and went to the county jail for the first time. Didn't think I was an alcoholic, but I was sick for like a week. You know, I couldn't hold down no food or anything. It wasn't too severe, but that's the only kind of type of withdrawal I've ever experienced. But I have experienced it. So I don't want anybody else to have to go through it if they don't have to. And people have a better chance of success once they stabilize and have a clearer thought process.
Yeah, wow. Well, that sheds a completely different light on it for me. Well, thank you for that. Yeah, because I go to I attend at some of the meetings that they have, the coalition meetings and the Nahuan Community Warriors for Change meetings, I get the impression, okay, you could take this and if somebody is going through withdrawals or on the opioids, you can give them this and then makes it better. But yeah, to know the detail of that is completely different than what you hear from a group of people who are not going through withdrawal. They're not high or anything. So
I would like, there's so many questions and negative thoughts about the Suboxone, the buprenorphine, the TMAT program. And most of it is about, aren't you just substituting one drug for another?
Yeah, let's get into that. Yeah. What is that?
Well, that is some misinformed people who probably come from abstinence-based background and got themselves clean by going through a hard detox, like I just explained, and didn't need no or didn't use no medication to help them go through their detox. And so they're looking at the individuals who are using a medicated-assisted treatment, and they're saying this is just another drug. You're just substituting one drug for another. Well, it's just, it is true that buprenorphine is a scheduled medication, but it's not just any drug. It also has an opioid blocker in it. So it's going to stop a person from using opiates for the period of time they have the Suboxone in their system. And they're not going to be able to get high off the Suboxone unless they combine it with some other medication. And I'm not going to say that doesn't happen, but if you take a benzodiazepine, it's going to increase the effect that of both medications. If you oversmoke marijuana, it's going to increase the effects of both medications. If you take alcohol, you are putting yourself in harm's way if you're taking Suboxone and alcohol in combination, because it increases both, and they're both a depressant. So yeah, it's true. But taking as prescribed, it is not just taking another drug. And in that period of time that you're using the Suboxone or the buprenorphine, these are times when you're not going to be shooting opiates into your system. You're not going to be using a needle to shoot opiates in your system. I don't want to blanket it, but to say that, but it wouldn't make any sense, because you're not going to be able to get high off the opiate. I'm not saying you can't do it, but you won't get high. And then we have the people who are concerned about diversion. That is some of their main concern. You're getting the medication. I've seen you selling the medication downtown, which is what happens in a really small town. But I would say about this. The buprenorphine is a pure enough medication. The person who gets it, let's say you come to me and you ask for help, and I take you to my doctor, and my doctor gives you some buprenorphine or some Suboxone. And then you go sometimes just like a few hundred feet across the street to sell from the clinic to sell your medication, because that's sometimes just as far as you have to go to find a buyer for the medication. That medication is going to be used by somebody to manage their own opioid situation. They're going to be using the medication when they're in withdrawal, when they can't find any more heroin or something, And so when they use that medication, they're not going to be using opiates for 48 to 72 hours. So what it's saying, all that, the medication will find a home. The medication will be used in a way. You're not getting high off the medication. It's just used to stop your withdrawals. And so diversion does happen, but the process and the medication is pure enough in form that it's going to find a positive way to be used. Funny as that sounds, like somebody's diverting. And obviously when we find out if somebody is not taking the medication as prescribed, we first offer, you know, a treatment, a residential detox treatment, because if they're not taking the medication, then they're taking other things. Increased counseling. Sometimes we give them dose changes. Sometimes we move their dosage to once a day. You know, you have to come in tomorrow. Yeah, I'm giving you enough for today. Now we'll see you tomorrow. You know, we'll try to manage it like that. And if they're unable to follow these increased counseling methods, then we'll discharge them. So, and we just recently discharged like 12 people. So during the COVID, we had a big influx of participants, people coming in seeking treatment. When the COVID first started, there was people were afraid for their life. You know, when this first you first heard about the COVID and everybody dying out there in New York and every place else, it was clearly understood that people with a lowered immune system would be at higher risk. So we had an influx of people coming to the program. Did well for a while, but the eventually. Their true colors and their lack of motivation for change waned, and they were not a right fit for our program at that time. They can come back. You know, I stay in constant contact with all the people, even the ones we discharged. Let us know when you're ready, you know. And still, do you need anything? Can I help you? That's kind of how that goes. It is another drug, but it's a way better drug. It's way better than heroin. It's way better than opiates. Yes, there's diversion. That happens. It happens in every program. When you're in a place where people are getting medication, not everybody's going to take the medication as prescribed. That's just the way it goes.
So when that diversion happens and it finds another person,
mm-hmm.
And then that person is obviously addicted to opioids.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they're getting this medication, but they're dealing with their withdrawals,
mm-hmm.
but they're not getting high.
They're dealing with their withdrawals. And so the medication is taking away their withdrawal symptoms. Yeah, they're not getting high.
Okay.
But they're not going through a withdrawal. The same way we are prescribing it and taking a person in and giving them a medicated assisted withdrawal so they don't have to suffer through the withdrawals symptoms, is the same thing that a person is going to do on the streets.
On their own.
Yeah, on their own.
Because they couldn't get any opioids mm-hmm. that they were looking for, so they got this.
Yes.
It goes in the back of my mind, well, why don't we just supply that?
It's funny you say that, right? In 1970, France... You know, the very first manufacturers of buprenorphine or Suboxone, right? And when it was first made or manufactured, it went right on the shelves in France. They were unregulated. You could go buy it like you could buy aspirin or
a little dispenser machine.
Yeah. And so. Obviously, France was flooded with Suboxone. And what happened was that everything that had to do with crime, drugs, overdoses, infections, everything went down. Everything dropped. Overdoses dropped by 80%. I mean, everything just declined, all the negative effects of drug use, in fact, at that time. Sorry. And which is why today you can go to St. Joseph's Hospital, in withdrawal and get medication, Suboxone. You don't need to go through the whole programming. You don't have to sign the waivers. You don't have to sign no paperwork. You have to go in there and you can get it at St. Joseph's. And a number of other hospitals around the country are now doing that. And it's based on that, the effect that France had when they provided Suboxone unregulated. Yes. I'm kind of like thinking the same thing. You know, why don't we just like let people have it? But we are in a very regulated situation. You know, it's a Schedule 3 on the DEA narcotics list, which is what America does when they get something, when they get a new idea or a medication or something else that they find a way to control and make money off of. So,
well, so is there any other discussions happening on a national level about, like the marijuana used to be what was class one or whatever?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and now it's now it has other regulations, but it's more available, and people are making businesses out of it, and so you're not getting no longer getting busted for having seeds in your pocket. You know, I remember those days. And
yeah, do you remember the old? I remember all the sneaking around and going to the corner or meeting somebody, you know, in a car or in a house someplace, and everything was really covert and, you know, and worried about getting caught, you know, to buy marijuana. I think about that too. And I think, what if you told your kids, you know, all the crazy stuff that you had to do to smoke, you know, some marijuana, they wouldn't believe you. They'd be like, because it's normal today. It's been normalized. And so the children are not understanding the part of the drug war that some of us in our 40s, 50s, and 60s had to go through.
Yeah, and so now we're in the 2020s, and we have opioids.
Yes.
Then completely different.
Yes.
And far more dangerous.
Yes.
But there's solutions. There's alternatives.
The harm reduction is all about saving lives. And we know people take drugs. And we don't have to condone it. But nor should we judge people or bury our heads in the sand. It's not our job to do whatever we can to help people make informed choices about the risks they are taking. And that's a direct quote by Rose Gittens, a director of the pharmacy and for the U.S. I mean, we can act like it's not going on, but it's going on. It's just how we deal with it. And as I say, you know, prohibition has never worked. It's something that is shown to not work. I remember when they were like, not too long ago, when they were saying people can't buy alcohol here after 5 o'clock, until after 5 o'clock or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And they went to Willow Creek. I mean, prohibition doesn't work.
Yeah, well, they tried making this reservation a dry reservation, and we start losing too many people along the on 96.
That's trying to meet people where they're at and trying to remove barriers and helping people get to a sober, a financial place in life where they can start making healthy decisions on their own. Until then, a harm reduction technique is to help them and meet them and not judge them, you know, for being an addict. You know, the stigma from media or whoever is the one who gets us to think in a certain way about people has made the addict a pariah. And so as you move through in treatment, the harm reduction counselor is what myself and Jesse are. Our harm reduction counselor, we don't make judgments. We don't get upset when a person relapses. We don't think bad about the person who is not working and is not taking care of themselves or their children, which is very difficult. Those some of the topics I'm talking about, right? They're not taking care of their children. Very difficult to like continue to like not be upset or not, you know, get it, you know, angry with that person who's obviously, you know, not take care of themselves, but not your children also. Come on, you know. So it's a very difficult and trying keep your game face on, you know, in some situations, you know, with the addicts and our clients. But it's part of the job. It's part of what we signed up for. And so we continue on and continue to provide services. And like I said in the beginning, sometimes I feel like we're a social worker. Like Jesse has been out in the field. He is like, during the stimulus, so many people. When you talking about the stimulus?
I probably filled out stimulus forms for 30 plus people, all the way from Eureka up to Happy Camp have come in, or I've talked to them over the phone, got their information, filled out their stimulus pack, their stimulus for the government for the $1,200. So, you know, we were put in the paper, and then all of a sudden we started getting phone calls needing help. So we provided that for our people.
What do you think the reaction was? I mean, the outcome.
Well, you know, the funds helped them in a time when they needed it. You know, so it was positive for them, for their, you know, for paying for their lights, providing food, and whatever whatnot. So it was something positive for the community.
Okay. All right. So when you looking at the whole situation, you think, well, how did it get started? So it's a long road to address the cause. And that's it. And that's what you're actually doing. The root cause of addiction. And just, man, it's a puzzle.
I have a little story, like addiction as a disease, you know, and starting right there and moving forward and trying to think about is addiction a disease? I want to say 2009 is when I first started hearing that. And so I'm attending 12-step groups, Al-Anon groups, LBGDQ groups. Just getting my certification, right? I have to attend a bunch of different 12-step groups. And the theory behind that is that if I'm going to refer people to 12-step groups, I need to actually have attended and know some 12-step groups in the area that I'm serving. So I'm going to all these different groups, and I'm hearing the concept of I have this disease, or my family member has this disease, and they're talking about addiction. I'm like a lot of people. I grew up in the 12 steps. I grew up abstinence-based, behavior modification, theory of recovery. And so I'm like, this is not a disease. And when I asked them, can you explain to me how this is a disease? They couldn't. They're laymen. They somebody told them. They read it somewhere, so that's what they know, but they don't know how to explain it themselves because they're laymen in the understanding of what it is. And I would say firsthand, don't say that at an Al-Anon meeting, right? Because Al-Anon is a group of people who are parents, brothers and sisters, friends of addicts. They're not addicts themselves. So sometimes educated, mostly educated people in that room still couldn't explain this concept of addiction being a disease, but did not like being challenged in that setting. So they let me have it, you know. But so I got myself educated. I started going to school. I'm in working at a behavior modification program where the basic concept is this has to be something to do. This has to have something to do with your childhood. This has to have something to do with something that happened to you, which has made you an addict. So I went to school. I started educating myself. And I actually found out why addiction is a disease. And so addiction, the very first reference to addiction being a disease was in the big book, Bob and Bill, Ted, I don't know. And so they referenced addiction or alcoholism being a disease in the big book in the 1930s. The American Medical Association referenced this again in the 1970s, but didn't clearly say addiction was a disease. And then in 1996, the American Medical Association finally said addiction is a disease. And so I'm assuming that's where a lot of people get their information. The doctor says it's a disease, so it's a disease. But still can't articulate why it's a disease, which is sometimes a frustrating concept. You're like, this is a disease, but I'm not sure. Well, diabetes is a disease. How is this the same? Cancer is a disease. How is this the same? So basically, this is what I found out through my research and going to school and talking to some doctors. And when you use drugs and alcohol, extra dopamine is released from the back of your brain to the frontal cortex of your brain, and raising your pleasure center, called the hedonic set point, but you're raising your pleasure center in your brain. And so the brain doesn't know how to react. So what it does is it raises your pleasure center or your hedonic set point. So it raises it from, let's say there's a 5, it raises it to 8 or 9, right? And it's sitting right there and it doesn't go back to 5, right? So you are now in recovery. You've decided not to use drugs and alcohol, but your hedonic set point or your pleasure center in your brain is still up to 8 when it should be at 5. So everything you do, the things that you used to do that gave you pleasure, like spending time with your family, watching a football game, those can only reach the 5 point in your brain for pleasure. It can't reach the 8 that your brain is currently sitting at. So you have a chemical imbalance in your brain at this point, and you're not feeling any pleasure. And it feels like depression. It feels like anxiety. It feels like a craving. It feels like a lot of things. But that chemical imbalance in your brain is why addiction is classified as a disease. It will reset, but it's going to take a while. That one of the analogies is that 18 months is a safe bet for resetting, you know, the brain. One of the things that I would say about the way the brain is in protection, because it has tried to protect you when it resets your hedonic set point. But let's say you get an infection in your body. you get an infection from somebody, from a surface, from somewhere, and the infection invades your body, your brain, always in protection mode, always raises your temperature. Because the infection has come, the brain, boom, oh shoot, what's going on? Raises your temperature, and that's how you get a fever. When the brain has finally figured out how to deal with this, or it lessens to a point where the brain can understand it or manage it, your fever goes away. And that's just the brain, just in automatic defense mechanism to help you. And it's doing the same thing when you're invading your body with drugs and alcohol. It's protecting you by raising your hedonic set point or your pleasure center in your brain. And that is why that chemical imbalance, from what I explained, the 5 to the 8, is why addiction is classified as a disease. And that's in layman's terms. I mean, the doctors explain it way better and way differently. I don't know about better, but because I couldn't understand them. But that's it right there. And that's why addiction is classified as a disease. It's a chemical imbalance in your brain brought on by long-term or chronic drug use. The choice factor. Everybody's like, it's a choice. You chose to use drugs. You chose to drink, which is true, which is actually a true statement, right? But only 3% of our population are addicts, you know? And you're trying to figure those two things out. Well, we have one analogy. You got two twin brothers, and both of their parents are alcoholics, right? And then, or addicts. And one twin says, I'm an addict because my parents were addict, right? And the other twin says, I'm not an addict because my parents were addicts, right? So, I mean, yes, it's a choice. Yes, obviously. But there's a large majority of the population who can drink and do drugs recreationally over the weekend and then rest up on Sunday night and then go to work Monday through Friday and maybe not repeat that exact same episode for another month. You know? Then there's also a portion of the population who uses those drugs on a weekend and then they don't stop on Sunday. They continue to the next weekend and so on and so forth. And some of those people are genetically predisposed, you know, in that way. So I would say, did they have a choice? Yes, they probably shouldn't have used the drugs in the first place. But are their genetic makeup makes them at a higher risk to become addicted at a very high rate, you know? So there's that. There's also the socioeconomic factors involved. Are you able to make rational decisions? And your parents are, and your family and your community are using drugs. You know, how much of a choice is it really? You know, that you ended up using drugs. Like, if you just take people smoking cigarettes. If you smoke cigarettes and you're a parent, there's a very high chance your child is going to smoke cigarettes. And so did the child have a choice to smoke cigarettes or not smoke cigarettes? Yes. But because of the situation of the parents smoking and the other family members smoking, the rate goes up, you know, in those situations. So yeah, they still had a choice. But the social factors involved, the economic factors involved, and the community factors involved play a big part in how much choice you actually do have. So there's, for every person is different, but there's an imaginary line that is crossed into addiction from casual use, from recreational use, into addiction. And the funny thing is that once you cross that line, like for me, it might have been two cases of beer to get me into where I'm an alcoholic. For somebody else, it might be a keg of beer that takes them that long to become an alcoholic. But once you cross over that line into addiction, there's no crossing back. It's a, you know, you can't like, oh no, I made a mistake. You know, I don't want to be an addict. No, change my mind. There's no changing your mind once you've crossed over. So yeah, it is a choice. But once you've crossed over into addiction, there's no more choice. That's over with. You know, you're an addict, and you're not going to respond to drugs and alcohol the same way other people do. So yes, is a choice. Yes, addiction is a disease. Some people might say that the diabetic overate, you know, caused himself to have diabetes, chose to have it. Did he choose to do that? Some people might say the person who has cancer smoked. They chose to get cancer because they smoked, you know. You wouldn't say any of those things. But for the addict, you will have this really negative connotation about they really chose that, you know. So I would just say that you need to look at a lot of different factors involved in the choice. Yeah, that's what I got to say about that.
That's very good. Yeah, good explanation. Yeah, like that.
Thank you.
So we covered everything on the plate here?
I think so, except for I want to put a shout out for the coalition. You know, we're doing Zoom meetings. You can contact Rhonda Tripp over there at Kamau Medical Center for more information regarding that. You can see me and Jesse out there on the road. You know, I'm trying to get signs for our van, but everybody knows what it is anyway. The Matt van. Shout out for our Kamau board. Doing an excellent job. Eva Smith and our prescribing physician. You know, Friday's coming up, Indian Day, you know, so have fun out there. Sober fun, yeah.
Be safe.
Yeah.
You got any closing remarks, Jesse?
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad you guys, we got this program done.
Uh-huh.
And the information you shared is really important and opened, hopefully opens a lot of eyes. To find out and actually hear the complications with this whole situation. When you talk about COVID, yeah, we're okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's another situation, but yeah, everything is so complicated and just
convoluted.
Yes,
so many thoughts and people, and you know, it's a sticky. You know, you don't want to say too much, but you don't want to not say nothing. You know, you don't want to tell too much truth, but you don't want to lie. You know, it's sticky. You know,
because yeah,
you know, managing the system and pleasing and also wanting to thrive yourself, and so you don't want to make enemies, and so. Going on step by step. Okay, I got this week. It might not even be like another 4 or 5 weeks before we make another positive forward movement, but we're making positive forward movement. You know, it just takes a while sometimes. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you for all your work. It's really a positive step for the community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll end it there.
You have been listening to the Kamau and Community Coalition presentation of services available to our community. The lead producer is Rhonda Tripp, BSW Coalition Coordinator. The audio producer, host, and engineer is Joseph Orozco. This program was produced in the KIDE Studio 91, Hoopa, California. Thank you for listening.